Hello, it's News Talk's Jess Kelly here. Before we get to this podcast, I want to talk to the business owners out there who know the value of having the right partner behind them. When it comes to empowering your business, Electric Ireland is the trusted energy brand that Irish companies rely on. As Ireland's leading energy supplier, they offer fixed price plans, expert advice and future-focused solutions, including solar power installation to support your business on its journey to net zero. Electric Ireland, making your business brighter. Visit electricireland.ie/business to learn more. Now, enjoy your podcast.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullen.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullen and this is a show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. I'm back after Christmas in Cork and I'm raring to go. I really, really hope you are too. Coming up on today's show, well, it was once the cutting edge of air travel, but then Concorde went the way of the dodo. But today we ask, is supersonic air travel about to make a return? We look at what effect Trump tariffs are actually having on business life for Americans and in particular the automobile industry. And since we're in the season of New Year's resolutions, we're going to look at the economics of dry January. Well, you can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, for my explainer this week and to get the show on the road, I'm picking an easy one that's often confused though. So Bulgaria joined the Eurozone this week. And sometimes people confuse the Eurozone and the EU. So the Eurozone is a group of now 21 countries that have the euro as their official currency. And of course, Ireland is one of those. The EU, or European Union, is a trading bloc. And of course, a country can be a member of that without needing to adopt the euro. If you needed any reference for that, of course, as you know, the UK was a member for quite a long time, but didn't adopt the euro. So while the Eurozone expanded this week, the European Union did not. So listeners of Taking Stock, Happy New Year and let's get started. It was once the pinnacle of air travel, but its popularity diminished and the 2000 Concorde crash signalled the supposed end of a consumer supersonic flight. However, whisper it softly, supersonic is making a comeback. Will it succeed and can it work in a more environmentally conscious age? I'm delighted to be joined by Jeff Wise, an aviation expert. So, Jeff, first off, let's go back to Concorde. It could travel from London to New York in 3 hours. What was it about the design of Concorde that could do that?
Well, you know, it was a time when people were very excited about flight. I mean, I kind of think that the late 60s were sort of the high point of aviation in a lot of ways, you know. Technology had reached, had allowed people to do kind of incredible things like get to the moon or fly supersonic commercially. You know, people, the first supersonic fighter jets had come into operation fairly recently. So everything kind of seemed new and possible. And we had this technology and people thought, well, let's use it. What often happens with technology is that just because it works doesn't mean it can work in a commercially viable sense.
Okay, and if we look at the physics before we get to the economics, like fuel flowed around the plane to adjust the center of gravity, particularly after takeoff. There was the droop snoot as well, because the design of the plane, if it was just a traditional one, the pilots couldn't have seen out through it. And of course, the other thing was that it was going to be moving at literally faster than the speed of sound. So what is it that made it possible from a physical point of view, apart from the technology?
Well, it's just, you know, it's, I mean, the problem of going faster than the speed of sound is that the air can't get out of the way. So it's kind of like driving a nail through a piece of wood. It's less efficient. Just fundamentally, you're going to be burning a lot more fuel to push this thing through the air. And that's why supersonic planes, whether fighter jets or commercial airliners, are going to be shaped kind of like a nail.
Okay, the air can't get out of the way in time. Right, that clarifies it for us for sure. So then let's move on to the 25th of July 2000. The Concorde punctured a tire during takeoff during Air France flight 4590 and 113 people died. So, of course, that was July. And then next year we had September the 11th. So talk us through that time frame and about why commercial supersonic flight just stopped.
Well, the Concorde was an older kind of technology. I mean, the cockpit was just absolutely crazy. It's all what we call steam gauges, like dials and things. It was pre-digital, right? So it wasn't computerized. You had to have a flight engineer to operate it. and it was inefficient. There was a very small fleet. It never made money. And who was using it? Like super rich people. It wasn't something that really benefited society in any meaningful way. So it was cool. Everyone loved it. You know, there's a thing, I write about all kinds of different technology, and there's kind of technologies that people love, just the idea of them, like blimps. Like people love blimps and zeppelins, and they're always trying to revive the idea of it. It just never makes any sense as a business. And that's what happened with Concorde. You know, when the danger became obvious, it was a bit like the space shuttle too. It's like once those things started to blow up, people were like, do we really want to do this?
However, of course, it is now coming back up in conversation because now we have the X-59. It's been designed, manufactured and flown to test both the theories and the assumptions relating to low boom technology. So this is back on the agenda. And also, you mentioned the price tag there. Well, you didn't give it a number, but it was available around about $20,000 per flight in today's money. Today, the economics suggests that it could be down as far as $5,000 per seat, and that would rival business class.
Well, I mean, when you project into the future of an aircraft that hasn't even been built yet, I mean, it's only like an experimental phase. It's historically a very common phenomenon where people say, oh, I've got this new technology. It's going to be faster and cheaper and better, and it's never going to break. And yeah, people always say that. It's going to be fantastically expensive. It's going to be for extremely rich people only. And it's going to have a tiny market. I'm very, very skeptical.
Oh, we can tell. we can tell that.
Yeah.
But first of all, let's understand the reasons for your cynicism. Let me go back to the physics. What has changed since 2003 when supersonic commercial air travel stopped to 2025? What has changed physically?
Well, engines are better. Everything's computerized now. So you have efficiencies deriving from that. You have safety deriving from that. I think that probably materials technology are better than they were in the late 60s. So I think you can build more reliable machines now. So there's lots of reasons why this idea would be better than it would be in the late 60s. So yeah, I'll grant you that.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for granting me that. Right. Let's move on to politically. And I have a lot more words that end with L-I, but L-Y, I mean to say. Politically, there's been a $600 million infusion of funding from the White House. Politically, what has changed here?
Oh, that the American democracy has become a fascist, you know, oligarchy. Yeah, it's. I mean, we now live in a society where everything that you would aspire to in a progressive, you know, life affirming society is being destroyed. So we are like reverting towards the Middle Ages, frankly. I mean, it's hard to overstate how nightmarish it is to live in the United States right now, if you have any conception of like human values.
Okay. Well, from that perspective, we cover what's going on in the US many times on the show. And I could, of course, continue with that part of the conversation. But from the perspective of what's going on, from the fact that there has been this money that has been invested into it, do you think then that that could change things?
Change things for the viability of
supersonic commercial air travel?
Right. So if all of the resources of society go to the 0.01%, right? If your operating principle is that everyone should either be a peasant or like some kind of elevated super god, then yes, this makes a lot of sense because you want to have you want to pour all of the resources into making sure that the extremely wealthy don't suffer even the mildest inconvenience under any circumstances. So yes, in that context, this makes a lot of sense.
Okay. And then, right. So now that we look from the perspective of politically and we've looked at this physically, let's look at this from a regulatory point of view as well. Because, of course, one of the key issues that held back the economics of commercial supersonic travel was the fact that regulation was introduced whereby this air travel could only happen across the Atlantic. How has that changed?
Right. So if you get into an environment, into a regime where the rich are allowed to do whatever they want, they can make sonic booms overhead. There's no concern about, you know, pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere until the oceans boil. If you don't really care anything about your immediate comfort, then the idea of like, yeah, having a few handful of people who can, you know, save an hour of their travel time when they're going to, you know, Art Basel or something, then yes, this all makes sense in that context for sure.
Sure. Okay. So let's look at this from the other perspective then. Why do you think this may not literally take off?
Well, if there is a hope that the United States would emerge from this period of intense societal derangement into a place where people want to use democracy to better their own lives and to be better versions of ourselves and start enforcing laws against even the rich and powerful, then I see an environment where people refuse to let this kind of thing occur.
Okay. And moving on then into the area of flight safety, because, of course, that would be the determining characteristic in between the two. Do you think now that flight safety in general has improved, not just supersonic, but in general?
Flight safety had been increasing dramatically. And that was the case that occurred because we had regulatory environment. We had people who deeply cared, who were professional, who were able to do their jobs without being randomly fired. We had a society that was built on people thinking carefully, having emotional intelligence, caring about one another. And that has been replaced by a society that is run by criminals for criminals for the sake of their own, you know, immediate gratification with no sense of consequences. Can you have aviation safety in that kind of context? I don't think you can. I think we are it's all kind of like servants for the king. And so people will say whatever they want to curry favor with the powerful. So aviation safety will decline along with every other measure of human well-being.
Are you being a bit harsh there, Jeff, to be fair? I mean, you know, for anybody listening today, including myself, who'd be a pretty frequent flyer, do you not just think that there are standards and regulations? I mean, the number of fatalities or the number of crashes have been steadily declining. I mean, there was one year there quite recently, I can't remember the year off the top of my head, where there wasn't a single crash at all in the air.
Right. And then a few days into Trump returning to power, we had our first fatal commercial air crash in the United States. I think the timing was a little bit random. I don't think he was responsible, having only been in office for a couple of days. But no, we had a very long streak that has since been broken. And a part of the failure, remember the MAX crashes, which were the fault of Boeing. Boeing was criminally facing criminal prosecution for that because its managers were, I mean, it was a perfect textbook example of how safety can be set aside in the interest of corporate profit taking. So Boeing had billions and billions of cash flow that they were using to buy back their own stock. They weren't investing in engineering. They weren't designing a new, safer kind of aircraft. They were just putting improvements on a very old kind of aircraft. And the result was the 737 MAX, which, you know, famously killed hundreds of people. So yeah, that's this basic situation, is that it takes a while for the piper to be paid, but the piper will be paid.
Okay. And as we come to the latter part of our conversation, I just want to move away from air travel, and I do want to look towards other forms of where it has been quoted that we're trying to shrink the world by making transport faster in between locations. Mm-hmm. Hyperloop. Do you think it is still a real life possibility?
I don't think it was ever really a possibility. I think that it was Elon Musk's attempt to distract from actual practical rail. It was never going to work. It's a terrible idea. In short, Elon Musk is great at he has a record of actually implementing some technologies, and a also even longer list of technologies that are just pure vaporware.
So I have to ask, Jeff, I described you at the beginning as an aviation expert, and I suppose I expected that was because you had a view that this is an area that's going somewhere. But as I'm listening to you, I'm hearing a lot of you know, not sort of great expectations around safety. You don't see the commercial supersonic or the ability to improve flight times for, we'll say, the greater masses. What excites you about your industry at the moment?
I have to cling to hope that, listen, I think the vast majority of people get up every morning thinking about how they can do their job to make the world a better place in some way. I think that you woke up this morning thinking, like, how can I make a really great radio show today? I wake up every morning trying to do what I do better. I want to inform the public and hopefully make them understand the world better. And I think that the people who work in aviation also want to make aviation safer, faster, more efficient, pleasant. I mean, aviation really can be a fantastic tool for knitting the world together. And we find ourselves in a time when there's some really bad people who, through ways that we're really struggling to understand, have frankly taken over and are moving society backwards. Why do I bother to get up in the morning? Because I think that there is hope. That if we can inform the public somehow, we just have to hope that we can get back on the right track. In that case, yes, I love aviation. I personally love to fly. I think it's an amazing gift that we live in a time where a normal person can get behind the controls of an airplane and fly around in the sky. That is a miracle. And so I am optimistic, but I think in order to move to a brighter future, we have to recognize what is misinformation, what is smoke blowing, and what is really valuable and what is really worthwhile in life.
Jeff Wise, aviation expert, thank you very much indeed for joining me here on Taking Stock.
Thank you for having me.
Well, a rather downbeat Jeff Wise there, who was ostensibly discussing the possible return of supersonic air travel, but ended up telling me why he's so fearful for air safety in the era of the Trump administration. This is Susan Ace Cullerton here on News Talk. After the break, how much do you think dry January might save you economically? Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. And now for my trivia this week. It's particularly seasonal, actually. So my question to you is this. What does the word resolution literally mean from its origins in the 14th century? Have a think about that and I will give you the answer at the end of the show. Well, of course, this is the time of New Year's resolutions. And this year, surveys suggest roughly 1 in 5 to 1 in 4 adults in countries like the US are attempting Dry January. So we wanted to explore the economics of Dry January. And who else to ask than the man himself, Conor Pope. First of all, Conor, Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, Susan.
You were certainly the person to reach out to on this. Can you talk us through what Dry January did for you 1 year and how it has continued?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I should say that I'm not speaking from a kind of a teetotal or a curmudgeonly or a, you know, prohibitionist stance here, but around exactly 4 years ago to the day, in fact, I decided, myself and my wife decided to do Dry January. And we did that. And like a lot of people, we got through the first week because, you know, the Christmas had been like boozy, as everybody's tends to be in Ireland. And then the second week it was fine. And then the third week it was like, it became kind of a mission to get to the end of the month. Then we got to the end of the month and we said, you know what, will we keep going for another month? And we did. So we kept going through February of 2022. And then in March, we got COVID. So obviously there was no boozing in March. And then we said, you know what, we'll keep going for 6 months. And the 6 months became a year, which became 2 years, which became 3 years. And now it's 4 years since either of us have had any alcohol at all.
And Conor, what did you gain in that period of time? Because I know the obvious question to ask you is like, what did you miss out? But I'm not going to ask you that. What did you gain? Well,
do you know what? I want to stress that I'm coming at this from a very non-judgmental perspective, because I think the last thing any of your listeners need is some holy Joe lecturing them on the perils of alcohol, because everybody knows the problems and the benefits of drinking a glass of wine or having a pint of beer, right? So I'm not doing it from any kind of judgmental perspective, but from my position, the gains have by far outstripped any kind of losses or any kind of pangs of longing I might have had for alcohol or for a pint or for a glass of wine. And I can't stress enough, but like, I like wine, I like beer, and I have absolutely no problem with anybody else drinking it around me. But from my perspective, I only really started to notice the benefits of not drinking after a couple of months. And there was health benefits, there was clarity of vision, it was much easier to get up in the morning, it was much easier to ferry children around to, you know, parties late on a Saturday night or pick them up early on Sunday mornings after sleepovers. Obviously, there was a weight loss element to it, but I don't want to highlight that in any great extent. But there was considerable health benefits, because I think an awful lot of us forget that when we're drinking alcohol and we're having a few pints, it does have a negative impact on us. And I think we're very good in Ireland at kind of brushing over that kind of stuff and glossing over that kind of stuff. But it really does make a difference when people do it. And I actually think in some respects, a lot of Irish people would like to give it a go, but they're kind of afraid to do it because it comes with all sorts of connotations of, God, you must be zero crack. And I totally get all of that stuff. But from my perspective, it's really worked so far.
And of course, I do need to ask you about the economics, of course, of Dry January. Is it all right to ask you, Conor, how much do you reckon you save per year?
Well, you see, this is the funny thing, and you'll know this. Like, I think the laws of economics dictate that your spending, like whatever savings you have, gets swallowed up by your annual regular spending. So, but like, let's just do a broad brushstroke thing here. So, let's say myself and my wife split a bottle of wine on four nights a week, right? So that would be four bottles of wine. Now, we wouldn't have been going over the top, wouldn't have been spending 25, 30, 40 euros on a bottle of wine. So let's say you're spending 12 or 13 euro on a bottle of wine and there's four bottles a week. It comes in at a kind of handy 50 quid a week. Spread that over 52 weeks of the year and you're looking at the guts of slightly over 2,500 euro. And then you have to factor in, you know, higher spending when you go out to parties or higher spending when you go to weddings or when you go on holidays or over Christmas. So I reckon we've probably saved around 12,000 euro over the course of 4 years just by not drinking modestly. And the figures I've given you there would bring me in at considerably less than the typical Irish adults spend per week on alcohol. So when you think about it over a 4 year period, there's 12 grand. We're 12 grand richer.
Well, I have two perspectives to share with you now on that. First of all, if you could get four bottles of wine for 50 euro, that is so 2022. Clearly, your numbers are not inflation adjusted. And the other thing, of course, Conor, is that if you save 12 grand, it took you 24 in order to get to that point.
100%. Now, I have to stress, and I think this is a really important point to make for your listeners, Susan, I don't have the 12 grand in my bank account.
Oh, where's the con, Conor, then? Like?
Lord only knows. Right? And that's the whole thing. And I think that's the nature of spending. And that's the nature of people.
Conor you're the consumer guru. What do you mean you don't know where 12 grand has gone in your bank account?
It gets worse, Susan, because when I was in my 20s and 30s, I was a fairly committed smoker.
Oh, God.
Right? So I was smoking maybe 20 cigarettes a day. Now, I can't even remember. Like, it's been a long time. I gave up more than 20 years ago. So it's a very long time ago since I bought a packet of cigarettes. But based on today's figures, if I was smoking 20 cigarettes a day, I'd probably be spending 120, 130 quid a week. But you spread that out over the course of a year and you're talking about thousands of euro that I would be, that I was spending on cigarettes, that I'm no longer spending on cigarettes, but I don't have that money either, Susan. So I don't know where that money's gone. But I'll tell you one of the things that I have done and I have discovered the joys of, which is the joys of non-alcoholic beers and non-alcoholic wines. Now, some of them are muck, but some of them are actually really good. Now, when I was a kid growing up, and you'll remember this too, Susan, the only non-alcoholic beer alternative there was on the Irish market was Caliber. Oh. I think it was called Caliber, and it wasn't great. Like, it was a poor, poor knockoff version of a real beer. But in the last 10, maybe 5 or 10 years, there's been a huge amount of investment by big breweries and by small microbreweries in non-alcoholic beer alternatives. And some of them are actually just out of this world good. Now, the thing is, they're not cheap. So I would argue that a lot of the cash that I was saving from not drinking alcohol has probably been poured into the coffers of these non-alcoholic beer makers.
Well, that is a really growing trend, all right. I see analysts are estimating that the global no and low alcohol drinks market at around $13 to $15 billion and growing at roughly 6 to 8% per year. So are we wrong to conflate giving up alcohol with giving up the drink?
I think that there's a couple of points here that I'd say in response to that. I wasn't driven when I gave up alcohol. I wasn't driven by money. Mm-hmm. I wasn't driven by the economics of it. I didn't do it to save money. In fact, I didn't do it for my health either. I just did it as a bit of a wheeze, a bit of a challenge, like an awful lot of your listeners will be doing for Dry January. And it kind of accidentally became a lifestyle choice because I enjoy not waking up with a muzzy head or a furry tongue on a Saturday morning or a Sunday morning. I actively like getting up early and doing stuff with a clear head. So it was never driven by money. It was never driven by health. It was just, as I say, a bit of a wheeze that has lasted this long. I do think that a conversation, people should have a conversation with themselves, with their partners, about how much we rely in this country on alcohol on social occasions. And it is in some respects integral to our culture. And I think that is in some ways kind of problematic. Now, one of the things that I really struggled with in the early phase of this was going to big parties or going to weddings, and you're kind of the sober one and everyone's going, oh, what's wrong with you? You're not drinking. Are you on antibiotics? Are you sick? Are you an alcoholic?
And if you're a woman, they'd be asking if you were pregnant.
And if you're a woman, they'd be asking if you're pregnant. And that that's a very, I think, a very uniquely Irish thing. But like in the last, like I'd say 18 months or 2 years, I've really leaned into the fact. And I remember one of the crowning moments of my sober sobriety was being able to sing Taylor Swift's Love Story at a wedding karaoke, completely sober, without any qualms. And I kind of thought, oh, well, I've cracked it now. If I can do that, if I can mortify myself in front of 150 people who I only half know, while without having drink taken, well, sure, I'm on the pig's back then.
And when we look, though, at Irish culture, over the past couple of months, Conor, on this show, we've looked at, say, the decline of the number of Irish pubs, or pubs in Ireland. I won't conflate the difference there.
Yeah.
We've also looked at the fact that it's certainly more younger people rather than older adults are drinking less. Like, you're going back there to when there was only one brand of non-alcoholic beer available. Like, I also remember in my childhood that social occasions often either happened in someone's house or in the pub. The proliferation of the coffee shop is really, I think, something that has come along maybe round about the late 90s onwards. So is this the trend, really, Dry January aside, is this a trend that you think might characterise Irish society more and more as time goes on?
Well, I think it characterises all societies, and I think Ireland has a long way to go in terms of the global move towards non-alcoholic alternatives. I mean, if you look at Spain, I think around 13 or 14% of the Spanish beer market is now non-alcoholic beers. And I think in Ireland we're around 1.5 or 2%. So we've got a long way to go before we get to the Spanish size of things. But I think one of the interesting things here is I would be very reluctant for us to lose our pub culture because we become, you know, like because we're maybe drinking less alcohol. Because I think the pub culture and the sense of community that it gives people is something that we should cherish. But maybe we should cherish it in a slightly different way. Like if you go to a Spanish bar, like you don't have people fall down drunk at 11 o'clock or midnight. You just don't.
So they're only getting going then with the length of time the Spanish keep
100%.
Going.
And like, I remember back in the 90s, I lived in Spain for a couple of years and it took me so long to acclimatise and get used to the fact that, as you say, they're only getting going at midnight. Because, you know, I would be doing the very Irish thing, like lorrying into the beers like between like 9 o'clock and midnight. And by midnight, I was like, I want to go home. And everyone else would be going, we were going dancing. So I think it would be nice if we were to move slightly away from this culture that you haven't had a good night unless you've been really properly plastered. And again, I'm not saying this in a judgmental way. I'm just saying this in a, I think we'd all be better off if we retained our pub culture, but maybe we shifted away from the drinks that really probably don't do us any good and moved a little bit more in the direction of drinks that probably don't do us any harm. And by that, I mean the non-alcoholic alternatives to booze.
And if we go back to Dry January for a moment, I found in a recent analysis that despite a rocky start to 2025, so this obviously relates to full statistics, 18% of US drinkers were still actively doing Dry January three quarters of the way through the month, with another 12% having tried and given up. It's just interesting there, you said about the third week there was a bit of a pivot point in your own experience.
Yeah.
What was that?
Well, I think in some respects, what I ended up doing was I was gamifying the notion. Mm-hmm. So it became a challenge. It wasn't just maybe we should just forget about it and have a glass of wine. We'd be grand. And like, I've done that in other years. Like I did that in the past. Like, this wasn't my first rodeo when it came to Dry January, but something clicked in my head. And I was just like, okay, we're 3 weeks in. Sure, feck it. We'll make it to the end of the month. And then once we made it to the end of the month, we were like, sure, February's a short month. We'll get to the end of February and that'll be 2 months. And that'll be a bit of a challenge. And as I say, it became a challenge. And I think people should probably look at it as an opportunity and a challenge and not as something that they have to suffer through. I've been looking a lot on Instagram in the last couple of days And a lot of people who, you know, like foodies or people who drink or write about wine are saying, why would you make an already miserable month more miserable by giving up booze? And I can totally get that notion. But the thing is, if you move it away from the idea that it's a miserable experience, because giving up alcohol isn't a miserable experience. In fact, it can be quite a life-affirming and fulfilling experience. And I think if we were to slightly skew the narrative away from, oh my God, I'm like some kind of pioneer here and I'm giving up booze and I'm giving up this thing and I'm losing this thing and I'm sacrificing this thing and life is miserable and sure, we haven't been paid for 4 weeks and we're not going to be paid for another 4 weeks and oh my God, woe is me. Like if we were to just slightly change the narrative and say, do you know what? Not drinking alcohol isn't actually a bad thing and it doesn't have to colour your life in a negative way.
And Connor, when it comes to the treat, we'll say the treat factor of, you know, it's Friday night, I've worked hard, or it's Saturday and we're having friends over. How did you replace that reward factor, or did you?
Well, that's a real challenge, to be honest, because like you do say to yourself, oh God, it's Friday night, time for a glass of wine. But that's habitual drinking. That's like the actual drinking of a glass of wine isn't in and of itself a reward. Like it's just a habit that an awful lot of us get into. And I was all in on that habit, believe me. So like a Friday night, as I say, there's some non-alcoholic wines that aren't terrible. Now, I have to say they've cracked it with the beer market. So you have a lot of really good non-alcoholic or low alcohol beers. And I have no problem drinking a 0.5% beer. It's grand. But so there's a lot of really good non-alcoholic or alcohol-free beers. When it comes to wines, it's a way bigger challenge. Some of the white wines aren't bad. Some of the rosés, the sparkling rosés, aren't terrible. The red wine is the one I really miss because I really like red wine. And for whatever reason, I don't know what it is, you need to get a scientist on the phone. The brewers and the winemakers of the world cannot replicate red wine in an alcohol-free version. And I kind of miss that. I'd like to have a really good, strong red wine with a block of cheese. I mean, like, what's not to love about that? But in terms of having to give that up, it's really a small sacrifice. And as I say, 2 or 3 months into it, the idea that the glass of wine at the end of the week would be a big reward, like, it kind of fades. And the one thing that I thought I'd really struggle with, by the way, and I did for the first year that I did it, was going on holidays, because I love going on holidays to some sun-kissed destination, usually a campsite in Europe, because I've got young kids. And yeah, I liked the idea of drinking the cheap red Riojas and whatever it might be, or the Albariños in the north of Spain, or whatever in Portugal, the Vino Verdes. I missed that. But 2 years in, 3 years in, I miss it an awful lot less now than I used to.
It's been intriguing to talk to you. And thank you for giving us an insight, not just into your own life, but into your home life, your holiday life, and into your bank account, actually, Connor, as well. I learned a lot about you in that conversation. Connor Pope, consumer guru, a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks a lot.
This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on News Talk. After the break, we look at how Trump tariffs might be affecting American life. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here in News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. Well, much has been written about the trade war of 2025, particularly about the impact that the trading partners like our good selves were either worried about or that we did feel as a result of the tariffs. But far less has been said about another of the profound impacts of Trump's tariffs, and that is on the business demographic in America itself. So specifically, what we're going to look at today is what is the reality of this trade war on the car industry. Jordan Dahl, mobility reporter at Politico Europe, is joining me today. First up, Jordan, the White House tracker, I checked it before I came on air today. It notes that the US has seen a surge of private and foreign investment that is fueling job growth, innovation and opportunity across every corner of the country. It says the value of that is $9.6 trillion with commitments from companies from household names all over the world. So have tariffs worked then?
Well, they work if you are counting announcements and theoretical plans. As with most things, the devil is in the details. So a lot of companies, particularly foreign automakers, have announced big investment strategies for the United States. Mercedes announced a $10 billion one. Toyota announced a $10 billion investment plan over the next 5 years. The chairman went on stage with a MAGA hat last month to make this announcement, fully paying homage to Trump. But these investments are over the course of 5 years. And they're in things like research and development. They are investments in existing plants and infrastructure. So yes, if you're only looking at numbers on paper of what's been said will be invested into the economy and the jobs, sure, maybe it measures up to $9 trillion. But we still have to see what actually comes through with that. Most of these plans have not actually been put into the ground yet.
Okay. I'm picking up from your point about theoretical plans, as well as the follow through in your answer there, that you're very cynical that this might actually come to pass. However, I would imagine that the White House should be as discerning as you sound that you are. Why is it that the White House then might simply buy into this about announcements or, as you say, commitments to existing investments and so on? How is this getting by President Trump?
President Trump is famous for his rhetoric, less famous for the actual details and the facts behind that rhetoric. He is known for boasting about plans that may not ever come to pass. So this is really in line with his reputation in the first term and now with the second term. And it goes with this sort of messaging that he's giving to American consumers who are struggling a lot with the much higher prices. You know, I'm American and I was there earlier last month and I saw for myself how much prices have gone up. So consumers are really feeling the impact of this. So he has to make this worth their while. And these sorts of investments and this rhetoric really help him bolster that case when consumers are wondering, hey, wasn't this for me?
Okay, well, let's shift to another dimension of the US economy then. If we look around industrial America, and I want to stay there, the latest US manufacturing jobs report, and that was out in November 2025, admittedly, of course, that would have been delayed data due to the government shutdown, but it did show continued weakness, totaling around 94,000 jobs lost in manufacturing over the past year. The policy of protectionism was supposed to not just protect jobs in manufacturing, specifically manufacturing, but to grow them as well. The opposite has happened.
Yeah, exactly. And that you can really point to some of the tariffs, particularly what is happening with Canada and Mexico. If we're talking about automakers specifically, the whole supply chain is very interwoven across borders between Canada and Mexico and the United States, where a car is passing multiple times before it ever reaches a dealership. But a lot of these companies that are working on this are not necessarily your Mercedes, your Jeeps, you know, your Volkswagens. These are smaller, medium-sized companies that are producing a particular part here and there. And those are the ones that have a lot less maneuvering to do and the ones that are ultimately having to close. Trump has also rolled back a lot of the emission standards in the United States, including Biden's big push for electric vehicles. And that has seen a lot of these battery factories actually shutting down.
Now, I want to delve into both, because when you talk about the impact of the tariffs in individual companies, particularly if they're across borders or anything else, can I ask you, Jordan, do you think it is clear for companies what tariffs apply to which bit of their supply chain? Is it clear?
No, not at all. This requires like a PhD and I don't know what to try and figure out. And that's part of the problem, is there's a lot of confusion and it keeps changing.
Okay, now, also, when you talk about confusion, I just want to ask about something else. I was looking at the earnings call for Dollar General. And as you know, that is what we might consider a pound shop or euro shop in lots and lots and lots of parts of rural America. So it does take the pulse of the individual, the mom and dad living in a house, going to work, paying for gas, etc. And I was interested that despite inflation, that the value of the shopping basket is flat. In other words, people are spending more, they're not getting as much for it because of the impact of inflation. However, if we look at overall growth in America, or if we look at the broadly the employment figures, etc., my question to you is the boom in AI investment actually masking the real picture of how a person might feel in downtown Missouri?
Totally. You have to really decouple what is happening on the coasts, and particularly in Silicon Valley and the finance world in New York, from the rest of America. The two are almost completely, you know, crossing over. The Venn diagram between them is really, really tiny. So you have all of these really big investments in Silicon Valley. Then you have the stock market in New York. you tend to have a lot more wealth on the coast, but that is not going inland to your point, the family in Missouri. And those are the ones who are really feeling the majority of the impact of these tariffs.
However, as you say, though, the other point is it's not just about what is being spent or what is being changed. It's also about what has been rolled back. Can I ask you just to delve a bit more into the fact that the rolling back of the emission legislation, like what impact is that having apart from, let's say, the supply chain who might have been really specializing in green energy or EV, electric vehicles, etc.? What are the other implications, no matter how high level or low level you want to go?
Yeah, I think we should take a look at globally at what the impact of this is going to be. So the United States was going really strong into electric vehicles, trying to get battery manufacturing up, trying to get a critical raw material supply chain created to be able to go head to head with China that has gone really full steam ahead with this. And Europe was similarly trying to follow in the United States' footsteps in this. But the US is now rolling that back. Europe last month also did the same to its landmark 2035 combustion engine ban law. So now we could see a bifurcating of global markets where you have the US and Europe that are hanging on to the diesel, they're hanging on to the combustion engine. And then you have China, who, as I mentioned, is going really ahead in EVs. They have better software, they have better technology and know-how. And that is now spreading to emerging markets like Latin America and Southeast Asia. So you could see two very different worlds of the combustion engine ban and then everywhere else.
However, you mentioned about having better technology, for example, in China. I would argue that the big issue in Europe, and you're joining me from Brussels, so feel free to agree or disagree, is the infrastructure, is the charging, the ability to charge, the ability to deal with range anxiety, the ability, of course, to sell an EV as well in a secondhand market. If those aren't addressed, that's the challenge from the demand side. Supply side is different, but from the demand side.
Yes and no, it depends on where you are. Europe is a really big market. If you're looking at Western Europe, the charging infrastructure actually is there. Now, if you're looking more at Romania, Slovenia, you know, Greece or Italy, then things get a little bit patchier. But last month, along with rolling back the emission legislation, the commission did put forward a corporate fleets law that is intending on solving that demand equation, because most cars that are on the road are actually company cars. Think of this as like a perk that you give workers. And so the idea is that those will have to electrify, and that will then create that secondhand market that will create the charging infrastructure. So they're trying to address that gap. But as with most things, it really depends on where in Europe you are.
Well, can I was about to make a pun. I'm going to make a pun. If I could change lane here for a moment, I was struck by the most recent piece you wrote in Politico saying China is the real winner of the EU's combustion engine ban reversal. And I wonder, Jordan, whether it's actually bigger than that. I wonder whether AI is being backed to the hilt in the US. China, on the other hand, it's backing AI, yes. It's backing EVs. It's backing green energy. I wonder, is the bifurcation of the auto market actually a looking glass into a bifurcation more broadly on the big bets that will define the next decade?
I think in many ways, yes. I mean, the United States and China are both investing a lot into AI. These are the two that have the most investments into technology, into what's going to be defining the next decade, as you say. But there are also a lot more policies and protectionism and looking at what are the national security implications of these different softwares. And so in the automotive sector, you're seeing them develop cars in China for China. The parts that are in those cars tend to stay there because they're not allowed in American cars, and Europe could go the same way. Now, whether that will extend to Latin America and Southeast Asia and these other emerging markets, we'll have to wait and see. But I can certainly see that then extending into these other sectors that are seen as really critical, not only to the economy, but to national security and overall sovereignty.
Well, if we also look at the size of the businesses that we're talking about here, like you mentioned of the companies going into, well, you didn't say bankruptcy, but say the companies shutting down in the US who are producing batteries and so on as a result of rolling back on the emissions legislation. If we look at the actual size of the business being affected by, we'll say the tariffs or we'll say any of the things that we've spoken about so far, One of the things that annoyed me about the analysis of 2025 is how people kept saying that the stock market is getting it wrong, how the stock market is just totally out of kilter with the economy. But the stock market is totally out of kilter with the economy. If you have 500 companies in the S&P 500 and you have 7 million companies in America, like the fundamentals between them can be quite divorced. What are you seeing about the impact of any of these developments between big business, small business, startup, like the nuance in the private sector?
It's a good question. I see a lot of what we saw in the pandemic starting to play out again. So in the pandemic, everything shut down. Smaller companies were closing in droves. The big companies could handle it, but they were laying off workers. And we've not really seen that end. Layoffs are continuing in tech. They're continuing in finance to a lesser degree, certainly, but it's still happening. But those companies have so much financial power and so much money in the bank that they have been saving for moments exactly like this. They have capital that they can move around, whereas these medium and small companies, that's just not the case. And it's really a year-to-year kind of looking at the balance sheet situation. And so those ones are closing up much more easily and much more quickly. And I think that is also a broader statement about the state of the American economy. You know, you could substitute these big businesses for wealthy individuals and you see the same thing happening.
And you're based in Brussels, like we said. The Draghi report continues to come up on this show and on many others on EU competitiveness. What do you think Europe can do to really distinguish itself? Now, as you say, it's rolled back on the combustion engine aim for 2035. What do you see, whether it's the auto industry or further, that you think Europe can do to really compete against the two superpowers, both sides of us?
Well, what they're attempting to do is these omnibuses that everyone is talking about in Brussels. These are massive simplification measures, but they turn out that they're actually not that simple at all. And they're creating, you know, other sorts of problems. You see the European Commission rolling back a lot of their green measures that they had put forward in the previous term, sort of in the name of competition in response to the Draghi report. But none of these are really bearing fruit yet. A lot of these are kind of typical European bureaucracy of we'll make a plan, but then the plan is never really instituted. So I think a lot of it is going to be depending upon foreign investments and private investments into the economy. I think there's only so much that politicians and policymakers can actually do. But in order to really compete with the United States and China on any of these future technologies, automotive, AI, or otherwise, they need to create a really strong technology and innovative industry. And that goes far beyond, you know, writing a couple of papers and then saying, we're going to invest, let's say, $3 billion in batteries. Well, that's a drop in the bucket compared to what China is investing. So they would have to really put a lot more muscle behind it and make sure that they can actually attract investments into Europe.
Well said. Very well said. And if Mario Draghi is listening, Jordan Dahl is available to be on your committee in order to turn Europe around. We really appreciate your time today. Jordan Dahl, a mobility reporter at Politico Europe, joining us from Brussels. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes-Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and hopefully learned something about economics and how it affects our world. Now, my trivia question to you was this. What does the word resolution literally mean from its origins in the 14th century? I actually really like the answer. It is, back in the 14th century, the word resolution entered English from Latin and it was originally defined as the process of reducing things into simpler form. So there's some inspiration for you today. Well, I just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the Go Loud app. Download it now. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy. And on research this week was Tessa Njoku. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day. And once again, a very happy 2026. I look forward to chatting to you again next week.